Hello, and welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations with professionals in the nonprofit world. I'm Janice Cunning, and I'm here with my partner, Margaret, and we're happy to introduce our first guest of 2022, Rowena Valen, who is the founder and lead instructor of the New School of Fundraising. Welcome, Rowena.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Yeah. So we're going to deepen our conversation around a post that you wrote on the fundraisingleadership.org website about bringing Indigenous protocols to your organization, which I asked you to come on and talk about because you've actually been writing about this in a couple of other spaces in Canada. So we'll put some context around you being a Canadian. And
I'm going to interrupt for a second. I would love to just offer the context that what the New School of Fundraising does is helps fundraisers at all the different points of expert learn something new, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so that's, I just want to provide that because I think the conversation today, like, that's important.
Yes, so. Yes. And Margaret and I are looking forward to being guests of the New School of Fundraising later in the year. You'll hear more about that as we get closer to the date. But I think what I'd love to do, Rowena, is have you first talk about your grandmother who you write about in the piece, because that really is a big part of the context of where in your heart, like where this work comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity to share my family story and weave it into what we're doing with the school as well. I grew up in Northern British Columbia in Canada. And I was always told as a child that my grandmother was raised by nuns in a convent. And I didn't really question that. We didn't know in Canada, we had a residential school system where Indigenous children were taken away from their families and raised outside of their communities. We also didn't really know about that. I grew up and not knowing actually anything about residential schools or even that they existed. And I often think back on when that realization came to me, and it must have been maybe in my 20s or 30s where I realized that that's where grandma went to school. And she spent 15 years there. She went there when she was 3 and she left when she was 18, and she had never seen her family a day in that time. And so I think you hear about that in your, I must have been in my late 20s. But it's not until you have your own children that really hits home to you, I think. And when my daughter turned 3 and I realized that's when my grandmother went away, it was so heartbreaking to think about. She passed away last year at the age of 97, and she was tough as nails, I would say. I always say she was like, just like strong leather, that woman. She was not going to let, you know, residential school did not take her down, and life would not either. She raised 3 children. She had grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I wouldn't say we were very close. I think that she probably didn't know much about how to be close to family members in a way because of how she was raised. She provided for everyone, and I respected her. We didn't talk about her time in residential school. We respected the fact that that was something private for her. She said one day to me, you know what? She goes, I had a warm bed and I had an education. And that's not to say that she appreciated it, but she did appreciate that she had a few, you know, she took that with her into life after that. Her family life was quite hard before that. So that started a journey for myself, and my daughter's 8 now. And I often call it, you know, we're trying to find our way home. We are really a colonized family that has had a lot of privilege since that time. And we're trying to find our way back to a culture and community that we don't know a lot about at all.
Yeah. So Rowena, I'd love to ask, you both are Canadian. I live in Colorado. And so I know our listeners come from both countries. it's sort of self-evident, but I would actually love to just hear in your words, you talk a little bit about the family impact, right? I mean, this imagination as a mother, what it would be like to have your three-year-old be gone for 15 years. But the cultural piece too, I think is important. And maybe for people who don't know or haven't had the opportunity to think about that. Can you share a little bit about that impact?
Sure, absolutely. Really the purpose of, and I always want to start with saying I'm not an expert in any ways. It's all learning that really I've done and kind of common knowledge of what the residential school system was here in Canada. And the purpose was really to take the, for lack of a better word, what we used to call ourselves, take the Indian out of the children, right? They were not able to speak their own traditional languages. They were often given new names. They were taught English. They were, the girls were taught skills like my grandmother was taught very kind of homemaker skills, given an education that was very, very steeped in religion. She worked her entire life as a seamstress in a department store and retired from that. So she took that into her career, that skill that she was taught. So really there was zero culture. There was no culture at all, particularly for her because she didn't go home. Some of the children went home in the summer and on holidays, and I think they were able to hold on to a little bit more, but she didn't go home. So it was gone, completely gone. And when she was 18, her dad sent for her. She spent a little bit of time with the family. She didn't know what he looked like, yet she had to be introduced to him. And then she was just off on her own. So when we talk about being colonized, really that's the example. So really nothing, I didn't really understand even what would have been missing, because I had a great childhood and my dad had, was a wonderful dad, and my mom. And so I wouldn't say anything was missing until really this latest time of learning here in Canada and appreciating that beautiful culture. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah. And I think I'll just add, as a Canadian who's always been, very centered in like that identity, I think, like many people in this country, it's been a reckoning of understanding that this was a government and church sanctioned event that happened. And it happened for a long time. I mean, this was still happening in my lifetime. This is not like history of centuries ago. I mean, this the latest residential schools, I mean, they really were still operating in my lifetime. And I do remember we're learning a little bit at school, but most Canadian children did not learn very much about it. And so part of what has come up over the last little while is the government has embarked on a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there's been guidelines coming out of that. And what struck me most was the idea that we cannot reconcile anything until we face the truth. Mm-hmm. And that is something I think about very often. It's like, and that has implications in many areas of our life, right? It's like often we want to reconcile something, but we have to look within ourselves and actually understand and listen to, like, you are giving us a gift and speaking for your grandmother. She can't speak for herself anymore. And until we listen and understand, we can't move forward. So,
So curious, kind of what your story is about, why is this important in fundraising? What's the weaving together of this family history and the work that you do and love now?
I would say that probably starting 10, 15 years ago for myself, a curiosity started forming in me. I was lucky enough about probably 10 years ago to meet my chief of my community, our council, and start a relationship that I never had before. And that was really special to me. And I am a professional fundraiser, and I have been since the early 2000s now. And so I'm a part of this journey and I'm doing it alongside everyone else. And so as things started to change in Canada, and really internationally to some degree, because there are Indigenous communities impacted all over. Everyone has a story, and there's Indigenous communities that have been impacted around the world and in different ways, and every country is, many countries are looking at their own journey and how do they reconcile this, how do they move forward together, how do they make amends and atone for what happened in the past. But I lived it. And so, you know, we'd be doing a big fundraising luncheon and we would say, oh, should we do it? Should we have somebody come and do a traditional welcome from an Indigenous community? And everyone would look at me and I'm like, I don't know. I don't have any connections in that. But I think we should. And so I think on a fundraising level, nonprofits as well, we're so community oriented and empathetic and caring. We want to do what's right. But we didn't know what to do. And that includes me. And so we tried a bunch of things and we reached out to people, and then, and I don't mean to have criticism here, but then some people say, well, you can't ask Indigenous people for help because that's putting the weight on them, which I appreciate, but then we didn't know where to go for help, to know how to be proper and how to be respectful. And so I thought, well, the school could help. We are a fundraising school. We could help with Indigenous protocols specifically that have to do with fundraising, not raising money from Indigenous communities or Indigenous fundraising, but protocols for events. And we come out right at the beginning to say, we're not a cultural learning here. We are actually just talking about how to navigate this and be respectful and make these really important relationships. So that's kind of how it got all tied together. And part of why I jumped into the workshop with Nicole, who's our instructor, is that I have a lot of tales from the trenches. And that's what I provide, is some of the learnings that I've learned by doing it. And they're funny. And it's really on me. But I do come in and provide that side of it, because it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love, like, you I encourage everyone to read the post that you put up, but you talk about three things, like creating a safe space for dialogue, you know, inviting an elder. And I particularly love how you said you have a higher price for this, so you can pay the person. That is very key, yeah. You know, and then also explaining terminology. So let's talk about that safe space for dialogue, because you kind of alluded to it. Like, sometimes it's just having a place where you can admit that you don't know, or you don't even know what you don't know, or you don't know how to get to what you don't know, right? So, like, tell us a little bit about how you intentionally set up that workshop so that other people can think about how they might set up a meeting or some kind of conversation in their nonprofit.
We encourage that safe dialogue. We have a small group because we want it to be personal. We want it to be intimate in a way, and we want people to really kind of be able to support each other. And so I just want to share, we offered two private workshops in the fall to just kind of get our heads around what we were doing. And and somebody who participated in it said, she said, we listened, we learned, and we reflected. The valuable session will help us weave our learnings into the vision for our organization moving forward. And her feedback was also that she felt it was a very welcoming and safe space. So participants can say to us, you know, I don't know where to go for this information, or I don't feel comfortable sharing it. I'm, you know, a white settler, and this makes me feel bad. I feel uncomfortable. And we can just start there and talk about it and say, like, that's okay. I'm Indigenous and I feel uncomfortable. And so I would say that to them. I didn't introduce myself in my Indigenous heritage until about 6 years ago. And I sat down with my counselor at a family meeting and said, Clarence, how do I introduce myself traditionally? And he said, what? And he's from the community. And I said, I don't know how to introduce myself. And he goes, oh my gosh, you guys really don't know. Like, he was shocked. And so, you know, I think we set the tone right away for, we are okay with any of your questions and we encourage it. And that we're just people too. And Nicole, who instructs the course, she says, I'll make mistakes. I've made mistakes, and I will just apologize and say, I've tried my best. And that's okay as well.
Yeah. One of the things we do sometimes, Janice, it seems like when we set up a new space or group, is to ask people to give you the benefit of your good intentions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that
as a concept.
I like that.
Yeah. There's a assume positive intent, you know, like, yeah, intent, yeah, that, you know, and sometimes it's not there, and that's fine to like admit, you know, to see the truth of it not being there. But I do think there's a powerful lens of like, yeah, assuming that if someone made a mistake or said something that, but it takes bravery too, right? Like, that's what you're also speaking to. Like, you have to be brave enough to actually then say like, that upset me, or, you know, or I'm interpreting this wrong, but this is the way that it's landing for me, right? So it does take a lot of bravery, and yeah, it definitely does. But I think it's, you know, there's what's also coming up for me, actually, one of the founders of the coaching school that Margaret and I went to, I remember somebody saying, like, he always tries to make a mistake as a facilitator early on, like do something kind of that people will notice, because it's like Nicole saying like, I will make a mistake, but actually making a mistake and then having to clean up the mess that you created. I think that's the most powerful learning, because people, you know, often we say it's okay to make mistakes, but until somebody actually does and you get to the other side and everybody's like, we're still alive.
Yeah.
I think
there are a lot of people out there who actually don't think it's okay to make mistakes. Yeah. You know, it's okay for other people to make mistakes, but
that is true. That is true.
A lot of people are deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah. So there is some, I think there's something very powerful about you as the head of the school, you know, like being willing to jump in there and tell a very authentic story about the time that you got it wrong or that you totally didn't know. And then, yeah, like that really is walking the talk, right? And then people can see like, okay, well, if you as like, you know, I'm looking at you and you're an Indigenous woman and it's okay that you didn't know, then, oh, as for me as a white settler, it's like, it makes me feel like much better to think that I am also allowed to admit that I don't know, right? We get so much in our way about thinking that we're supposed to be somewhere, you know, on the continuum, and just rather than just accepting that, it's like being willing to have a conversation is really the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love what you guys just said, because really, I think that's my role as well in the workshop is I do share, I kind of our mistakes or missteps, but I think sometimes as fundraisers as well, we are very structured. And when you bring 400 people together in a ballroom for a fancy lunch, and you charge a lot of money for that, you know, you're down to the minute on that event. And one thing that we really, you know, want to get home in this is your guests are not there, that you respect their timing. And, you know, one of the situations I give is I said, oh, we're looking for about a 5-minute welcome. And that turned into a 20-minute welcome. And it's not like they can ask them to leave. And when, you know, at the end of the day, from the whole luncheon, and it was a leadership luncheon, the feedback I got for the rest of the year is how much people enjoyed that part of it. That's what I heard most of anything. That was so memorable. I was, meanwhile, like sweating.
I was apoplectic.
Oh yeah. My gosh.
Like, where's my hook? Get this plane off this
plane. What is happening? But, you know, it's so, like, that's what we want to get home is, you know, kind of all your planning needs to be adjusted, and you need to kind of go back to the heart of what we're doing.
Yeah. I love that. You know, Margaret and I, you know, we like what we do in our business is we co-lead things. And so we have a very loose agenda, you know, and when we're doing things with, and I'm often looking at the clock and thinking to myself, oh, I wonder how this is all going to work out. Because it seems like we're completely off schedule, but it always does. And like what I love about what you just said, Rowena, is like, because whatever is important, like it needs to be honored. Like if something is taking more time, but it's important,
yeah,
then you just actually have to let go. But that can be very hard when you are in event planning to like actually accept that you have to let that go. Yeah, that's so funny.
Amazing. Antithetical to the personality type of people who plan events, right? Who really like, as I was reading and thinking about your work in these workshops, are there things in individual fundraising that you want people to take with them with, you know, with this work, with this lens, with this frame, how we show up with
funders? I think, you know, I think this is also something that I've been walking through. I went on a work trip with our CEO and our programs lead, and we went and worked and met with an Indigenous organization in Northern BC. This is a few years ago. And we walked in and I mean, warm hugs and just the most welcoming, heartfelt welcome ever. And we all sat down and I just got to business. I was like, okay. And I just started and I could see by the look on the face of the women across from me that I had misstepped. And as a fundraiser, we're always looking at reading our room. And she was like, you're from Prince George, tell me about your family. And I realized that it wasn't about getting into business, it was about getting to know each other. And so I think one of the things that Nicole and I'll say in that is, you know, these learnings are not, it's not like we can say, oh, Indigenous person, this is how they are, or this is how to treat them, or this is how to behave with them. It's not like that. There's so many different cultures and subsets and languages and protocols and all of that, but there's certain ones that come to play for a lot, kind of almost form foundational, and these beautiful relationships tend to be something like that, right? So really with individual fundraising, when we are fundraisers, we are about relationships, and we are about, you know, fundraising is not just the money, it is about the relationship. Right. And when you're working with Indigenous people, it's about relationships, right? And I think that's kind of key as well. Like it for anyone else.
Don't skip over the welcome, right?
Yeah.
That's important. And we don't have enough time for it. That's such a great metaphor.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me, because we used to have another person from Spain who used to do some work with us, Sylvia. And I remember her saying, like, in Spain, you go for lunch, you know, a business lunch. She's like, but you cannot talk about business until dessert, because lunch is like to be enjoyed. You talk about your family, you know, what like trips you've taken. And she's like, it's very insulting, actually. And then when dessert comes, it's like everyone in that culture knows, like, okay, now we shift, right? Yeah. And, you know, so that story like reminded me, I was sort of thought, and that's I was like, that's nice, isn't it? You actually get to enjoy and eat your lunch.
So nice. That's amazing.
So we're going to, we'd love to give everybody something to try. So we're going to transition to that in a second. But I think it would be helpful, as Margaret pointed out, you know, people are listening from different parts of the world, and you know, people have different recognitions of sort of, you know, just levels of understanding. So let's talk about what a land acknowledgement is, because that is a big piece of what you talk about in the blog post, but just give us some context of like, you know, what is that if somebody's never even heard of this?
Well, this is also a journey that I've gone through as well. I heard a woman speak once about the meaning behind land acknowledgement and why we do it. And it was so lovely. And Nicole talks about it in our workshop as well. And it is to acknowledge, it is to take a moment first. If you're going to do a land acknowledgement, you have to know the traditional territory that you're on. So that's the first step. And then it is to acknowledge that you are guests on the territory and on this land. And so it might be a territory, it might be unceded territory, it might be treaty territory. It's different where everybody goes, but that you are a guest on the land and that you give thanks. I've heard recently somebody was saying it would be like going over to someone's house and not acknowledging that you're in their house. And so really that's, we're in someone's house. And when we start, even at the school, I can share, my land acknowledgement. So if I was opening a workshop of the school, even if it was by Zoom, I would say, I am honored to be on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, which is represented by the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. And then I make it personal for myself. So I think often it's not to feel like you're checking a box, but I would say, I often share, I am neighbors with the Squamish Nation. My neighborhood is actually community neighbors with them. And during their summer powwow, in non-COVID times, because I haven't heard it for a while, for about 24 hours a day, for a few days in a row, I can hear the drums from my house. And there's nothing like sitting in your yard and hearing that beautiful drum and giving thanks to them for stewarding this land that we're on. The other day we had some rains, and so I opened up a session and I said, I said, thank you. And I did my land acknowledgement. And then I just talked about the weather or the beautiful mountains that I can see outside of my window that are snow capped. So really that's kind of the purpose behind a land acknowledgement. And it's probably, we do recognize that it's done differently in many different areas.
Yeah. But Rowena, what I hear you saying is, as you talked about, you know, the reason for this work and teaching fundraisers, you know, we're generally big-hearted people, and I almost hear there's an invitation to, you know, take a leadership role. You know, you guys care about things and ethics, and this is a way that anybody can be part of a reconciliation movement, whether you're in Canada or someplace different.
There is, I think, you know, there's definitely our own individual things that we can do and choose to do. There's things that our organizations can choose to do. And I'll share that even our NHL teams, so our hockey teams in Canada, many of the teams here are choosing to do land acknowledgements at the beginning of their broadcasted play. So that will start to be seen more across the board when they are able to play hockey. And so I think what we're seeing is that it's becoming in Canada more and more common. And what I don't want to see is if you aren't doing things properly, it's almost surprising now. And I shouldn't say properly. If you're not doing that, people notice. And I don't want our nonprofits to open themselves up to a criticism of something missing, really, at a big event or anything like that. So yeah, I think there's steps we can do individually, and there's steps we can ensure organizations are doing, and there's ways to take baby steps, right? We don't have to just know everything and jump across the finish line, but if we just make a commitment and start and just put our hearts out there as we do it, I think that's perfect.
Yeah,
and one thing you talk about in the post, which I love, is like if it's not something your organization's doing, then start internally. Like, first of all, you know, look into it, discover, you know, where you are situated, and then you talk about, which I think is a great something to try, like have the team rotate and everyone do it. And it reminds me, you know, Margaret and I did this leadership program where we would do a morning ritual, and we would take turns sort of leading through it. And the people who did it the most impactfully let go of getting it right. Like, it wasn't about, you know, ours was about the, you know, the South and the North and the West and the East, and sort of giving thanks to the space we were in. And if you get caught up in it, it doesn't come from your heart. Yeah, so I love what you're saying.
It doesn't resonate in the same way.
Yeah. It's like, you know, maybe you'll stumble over it. It'll feel uncomfortable. It doesn't matter. What matters, what I'm hearing so much from you, is what matters is that you've felt in your heart the gratitude for being. And I think that's such a good way of putting it. Like, yeah, you wouldn't go to somebody's house and not thank them for having you in their house. It would just be strange, right? To just barge in and start doing whatever you wanted to do in somebody else's house. So I think that's what's hitting me is do it enough that you get over the kind of, you're always so in your head when you first do something, and get to the point where it's like you're actually doing it from your heart.
Yeah. And we, I mean, these are also community, like these are words that are sometimes harder to say and pronounce. And so part of our workshop is to give helpful tips about how to find out how to pronounce, you know, who can you ask how to pronounce your territory, community names, nation names, whatever that they are for your community. We have a Foundations for Fundraising course, and at the end of our course time, we do what's called a community of practice, and the participants get together once a month for 3 months, and it's participant led. And so each of them takes turn chairing. And we had a young woman who opened up our community of practice a few months ago. And I said, do you want to do a traditional welcome or would you like me to? Because I take a backseat role to this. And she goes, oh, I've never done one before, a land acknowledgement. And she's junior at her organization and it's done by different people. And so she got really excited and she did it. And you could just see like her confidence. I said, how was it? She goes, it was amazing. And she goes, I was nervous. And then I did it. And I was like, oh, I can do this. And so that's what, you know, that's a safe space for her to do that in. And she was excited. And then we had another one yesterday, actually, and this young woman from Ontario, and she did a land acknowledgement. It was beautiful. And then she did a whole small talk for about 5 minutes of the group of what that means to their community and what that means to her. And I was in tears. It was beautiful.
There's so much. I do want to say, your course is open to Canadians, correct?
Yeah.
And yes, we have a link to it, but I heard from you that it's very close to selling out. So if anyone's interested, get in there quick. There will be another one.
Correct? One spot left. We have another one coming up. We run all of our workshops. Some of them are, you know, common ones every month. And then other than that, every 2 or 3 months. So there'll be another one coming down the pipe. And if they get really, really popular, we get a lot of interest, we will schedule more before then. Okay.
Awesome. So we'll link to your school and the workshops and your LinkedIn. So there's lots of ways that people can find you, of course. Yeah. One lucky person will get that last spot and then everybody else can get into the next one. And I'm sure you'll create a waiting list if need be for future ones, but I'm so appreciative because when we were connected and we talked, it was such a spark. And then I said to you, like, this is just something we haven't talked about. So thank you for sharing your family story, your personal story, and more about the school and bringing something to us that our listeners, you know, some people might be, may know about this and have reinforced some things. And for some people, it literally might be the first time that they've ever thought about something like land acknowledgement. And that's very powerful.
Yeah. And thank you for challenging us all to, you know, to be leaders in some ways.
Thank you so much for having me. And I truly appreciate the opportunity. I think this is a journey for everyone, no matter where we're at. And nothing but good will come out the other side of people opening their hearts and trying.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So yeah, we encourage you, that's something to try to get together with your teams and start to do those land acknowledgements, and most importantly, to do them from your heart.
This podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. Please subscribe if you haven't already. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a monthly or annual contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Make a contribution today using the link in the show notes. Now, go put it into practice. Yeah.